Vladimir Putin gets another six-year term as Russia's president.
The election in Russia is mostly falsified. That's why we are staying here, to show how many people are against Putin.
The EU announces $8 billion in aid to Egypt.
We are all extremely concerned about the war in Gaza and the unfolding catastrophic humanitarian situation.
And in Venezuela, where access to information is scarce, driving the news to people.
In Venezuela, there are more than 50 laws that restrict, criminalize, and block free and independent journalism in the country. The Ari Mobile is an alternative.
Today is Monday, March 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. In an election that international election observers have dismissed as having no chance of being free or fair, President Vladimir Putin won a record post-Soviet landslide in Russia's election on Sunday, cementing his already tight grip on power. Putin said the victory showed Moscow had been right to stand up to the West and send its troops into Ukraine. There were protests in Europe at Russian embassies and even inside Russia. Here's VOA's Arash Arabasadi.
Sunday, on the streets of Berlin, Yulia Navalnaya, the widow of former Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, joined a protest against Russian President Vladimir Putin. She walked with fellow Russians who'd lined up outside the country's embassy in the German capital to cast their ballots to determine who will lead the country for the next 6 years. Navalny supporters in Russia called for a midday protest on the final day of voting for those unhappy with Putin's tenure. Stretching far beyond its borders, Russians outside of the country lined up, sometimes for several city blocks like in Tel Aviv, Israel, to cast their votes in this year's election. A similar scene outside of the Russian consulate in Istanbul, as reports of voter lines ballooning after noon. VOA captured the moment when a nearby woman burned her Russian passport. The Kremlin released a video claiming to show Putin casting his ballot online. But at polling stations across the country, civil disobedience overlapped with civic duty. Vandals tainted ballots, pouring ink in ballot boxes attempting to render votes illegible, with arson burning another polling station in the Sverdlovsk region. While in St. Petersburg, a woman hurled a Molotov cocktail at a polling station before authorities captured her as she tried to escape. The 2024 Russian presidential election marks the second in which residents of Ukraine's illegally annexed territory of Crimea cast their ballots. Ukrainian officials call it a sham.
Holding elections in another UN member state's territory without its consent is in manifest disregard for the principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity. Such elections have no validity under international law.
And while a mix of voters at a Moscow polling station say they wanted new faces in leadership, others say they're happy with Putin and want Russia to stay the course. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Putin has ruled Russia for nearly a quarter of a century now, and this gives him another six-year term as Russia's president. He pretty much rules the country with an iron fist, so why put on the election show? Joining us now to talk about this is Professor Robert English, an expert on the politics of Russia and the former USSR. He's the Cold War director of the University of Southern California School of International Relations. Why is it important for Putin to put on this show? For his own people or for the world?
It's for both, and also for himself, for a third party. I think, let's start with that. He simply has a large ego, but like many dictators, he simultaneously has this megalomania combined with insecurity. And so, as we've seen with so many others, just the ritual, the performance, the ceremony seems very important to him. And so he orchestrates it very elaborately. As for his own people, yes, it's probably in his mind critical to his authority, his legitimacy, to show this overwhelming turnout and overwhelming support. even though many, if not most, know exactly how it's manufactured, or at least augmented, he has a certain reservoir of popularity, especially with the older generation. But we also know that the overwhelming propaganda and manipulation adds a lot to his voter turnout, to the support, and to his trust ratings in public opinion polls. Finally, I think both of those contribute to his perceived need for projecting strength abroad, that if he can show that he's backed up by his own people so strongly that he'll gain more respect, a greater margin of maneuver, that the West wouldn't think of trying to undermine him. At least they'll think twice, that they'll understand that that's hopeless, and maybe we'll be more likely to negotiate on his terms, something like that, where the big turnout and overwhelming support sends a message that you got to deal with me because I'm strong and nothing's going to shake my grip on power at home.
This is already nothing like the Russia, the Soviet Union of the past. There's no Politburo anymore. It's really a one-man decision-making apparatus. Where does he go from here? Where do you think he already pretty tightly controls everything, doesn't he?
Pretty tightly. It's a curious hybrid. You're right in that it's not a collective leadership the way the Politburo was at most turns in the Soviet period. It wasn't always, of course. Stalin was about as close to an absolute dictator as you can imagine, and a much more brutal and ruthless one even than Putin. But at other times, the leadership was absolutely collective decision-making by the Politburo. And sometimes even the official leaders were weak, so aged, so decrepit that power devolved to their staffs, to secondary officials. So it's varied over time. But yes, he is a dictator in a way that Gorbachev certainly wasn't, and Brezhnev couldn't be in his infirmity. Where he goes from here, it's hard to say, because he's not going to become more powerful, and he may require more repression and more physical violence to hold on to power if dissent grows, if dissatisfaction increases, if the war turns bad, and of course, if the economy turns even worse. We're seeing, you know, the casualty rates are tremendous. They just can't be maintained for months and months like this. And the economy, of course, is living on borrowed time. It's an artificial prosperity pumped up by printing money and running defense plants day and night. So those will run out, but not for some months, maybe even a year or more.
In the near term, do you think that he'll move to consolidate even more? Because I saw the protest votes taking place in European capitals particularly, but even inside the country where there were individual acts of vandalism at the polling places, I don't think I've ever seen that before.
No, that was really significant in my estimation, especially that inside the country. Outside at Russian embassies in Western Europe or United States, anywhere, there's not a great deal of risk to protesting, to demonstrating against Putin. But there is inside the country. And let's remember, probably thousands, maybe tens of thousands in total, participated in this so-called noon against Putin, this kind of noontime flash mob where everybody came at the same hour to vote, which is, of course, their civic duty, but did it in such a way at such a time that it meant I'm against Putin. That's something significant. It has to infuriate him. And let's not forget how hard he tried and his staff tried to prevent that. They spent, as we know from the documents that have leaked now, approximately $1 billion, right, to whip up patriotic fervor with contests and carnivals and music shows and all other manner of pro-Putin, pro-war propaganda to get the result he did. And on top of that, in these last weeks, they put out some considerable effort with hacking, with false messages, with going out to Navalny's base and those who might think of participating on Sunday at noon, saying it had been canceled, it was called off. They used all their sort of cyber tricks. And still tens of thousands came. So some might say that was a small number, and certainly they weren't armed and in rebellion. But the best they could do to suppress that, and tens of thousands still came out. So I see that as a crack in his armor, not as a sign of strength, but of impending weakness.
Hmm. Interesting. Professor Robert English with the University of Southern California School of International Relations. One of the issues addressed in both the Russian election campaign and in Putin's post-victory appearances was the Ukraine war. He said, in fact, it would be a mistake for Europe to put troops on the ground in Ukraine because it might start World War III. Now, while Putin vows to see the war through, the lingering possibility that Europe and NATO could become even more involved hangs over the Russian war effort. Here's Maxim Adams with more on this.
As the fighting in Ukraine enters its third year, some Western allies are contemplating the possibility of becoming more deeply involved in its conflict with Russia. In late February, French President Emmanuel Macron refused to rule out deploying NATO troops to Ukraine. Former U.S. Defense Intelligence Officer Matt Shoemaker says it was Macron's attempt to push back against Putin.
He certainly wanted to send the message to the Russians that and put them on the back foot, if you will, to put them on the defensive that NATO might actually get involved. But unfortunately, since President Macron did not give an indication to his fellow NATO members that he was going to say this, it certainly put them on the back foot as well.
But another analyst, Sean Steinberg from the Sufan Center, says some NATO boots are already on the ground.
Well, it is true that there are, it seems that there are, NATO advisors, or at least NATO member states have advisors and, you know, special forces on the ground in Ukraine. But I do think there is a huge, massive red line separating advisors on the ground versus U.S. and NATO troops fighting directly against Russian troops.
Retired Vice Admiral Robert Muret, the deputy director of the Syracuse University Institute for Security Policy and Law, says U.S. troops can be found worldwide, but that doesn't mean they are fighting.
Not every embassy that the United States has around the world, every last one of them, have a Marine Security Guard detachment. So we have Marines that do protection. So in small numbers, yes, there are active duty military personnel in Ukraine.
Ruslan Bortnik, the director of the Ukrainian Institute of Politics, says NATO deployment is inevitable.
Russia is a lot bigger than Ukraine, so there will either be a threat of Ukraine losing the war, or foreign troops will need to be sent to the country.
Bortnik believes that as an entity, NATO is unlikely to send troops to fight in Ukraine. But he says that individual member states like France, Poland, the Netherlands, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, or one of the Baltic states could choose to do so. Maxim Adams, VOA News, Washington.
We're following these other stories from around the world. According to organizers of Dublin St. Patrick's Day Parade, this was the largest St. Patrick's Day Parade ever, with a 500,000 people on the parade route to watch 4,200 street performers, pageant companies, and marching bands. They came from Ireland and across the world. The European Union on Sunday announced an $8 billion aid package for cash-strapped Egypt as concerns mount that economic pressure and conflicts in neighboring countries could drive more migrants to European shores. The deal, which drew criticism from rights groups over Egypt's human rights record, was signed Sunday afternoon in Cairo. Rio has set a new thermal sensation record after a neighborhood on the west side recorded 62.3 Celsius. That's 144.14 Fahrenheit. Happened on Sunday morning. A thermal sensation is defined as a heat index calculated from the temperature and the relative humidity. The Brazilian government news agency reported it's the highest thermal sensation record since the Rio Alert system began taking measurements in 2014. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Sunday he would keep on with the military campaign against Hamas in Gaza. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports that aid agencies say famine is looming and ceasefire talks are set to resume.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday pushed back fiercely against what he described as international pressure over the war in Gaza. At a cabinet meeting, he said, "To our friends in the international community, I say, is your memory so short, so quickly you forgot about October 7th, the worst massacre committed against Jews since the Holocaust?" And he repeated his determination to send forces into Rafah. Earlier on Sunday, Netanyahu also hit back at a speech made last week by the U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. The Democrat and longstanding supporter of Israel stunned observers when he directly criticized Netanyahu.
"The fourth major obstacle to peace is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu,"
and called for new elections in Israel. But Netanyahu is facing pressure from inside Israel as well.
"Election now to change the prime minister and the whole ministers."
Thousands of Israelis in Tel Aviv called for an election now during a protest against the government on Saturday night.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. In Haiti, the situation continues to decline. AP correspondent Lawrence Brooks reports that Guatemala says the offices of its honorary consul in Haiti have been ransacked. Additionally, the gang violence is getting worse across the island.
As Haiti once again spirals into chaos with another wave of gang violence, a number of government and aid agencies have reported that their facilities and aid supplies have been looted. Gangs have raged through Haiti in recent weeks, attacking key institutions and shutting down the main international airport. The chaos has pushed many Haitians to the brink of famine and left many more in increasingly desperate conditions. On Saturday, UNICEF said one of its containers holding essential items for maternal, neonatal, and child survival, including resuscitators, were looted in the capital's main port, which was breached by gangs last week. Speaking to crowds gathered at St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis has called for peace and solidarity in Haiti for the common good. He also expressed his relief that a teacher and four members of a religious congregation that were kidnapped there 2 weeks ago have been released. I'm Lawrence Brooks.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, says he does not fear being put on trial one day after a police investigation revealed the far-right politician tried to get the country's military chiefs involved in a coup plan to overturn his 2022 election defeat. More now from Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan.
Bolsonaro did not refer directly to the allegations, but he did refer to a trial he could face. Speaking at a political rally in Rio de Janeiro to back his candidate for mayor of the city in local elections in October, he claimed he was being politically persecuted by the Lula government because he was a thorn on the side of the left.
"I do not fear any judgment as long as the judges are impartial."
Bolsonaro has denied planning a coup after his election defeat, which he never conceded. He left for Florida to avoid handing the presidential sash to Lula. And days later, Bolsonaro's supporters stormed government buildings in an attempt to provoke a coup. Last year, Bolsonaro was banned from running for elected office for 8 years for abusing his power as president and repeatedly criticizing the country's electoral system. He could face possible arrest and a trial by the Supreme Court.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan. And finally, in Venezuela, large parts of the country don't have access to information. A media group has found a way around the laws, the lack of internet access, and other factors blocking people from getting the news. mobile news trucks. For Adriana Nunez, Robert Scull in Caracas, Cristina Caicedo-Smith has the story.
Navigating the mountain roads on the outskirts of Venezuela's capital, Caracas, Arimóvil delivers news to places where regular media no longer travel.
The main idea of Arimóvil is to cover parts of the news deserts that exist in our capital city and in our country.
Around a fifth of Venezuelans have limited access to information, and media is restricted, says media watchdog the Press and Society Institute of Venezuela. Some areas have little or no internet access. Elsewhere, radio stations have closed or are censored.
In Venezuela, there are more than 50 laws that restrict, criminalize, and block free and independent journalism in the country. The Arimóvil is an alternative to go where the people are to keep them informed, which is our job.
Their customers appear eager for the deliveries. A carnival-like atmosphere sweeps Turgua, a rural community about an hour outside Caracas.
Normally in rural areas is very difficult because sometimes the internet is very slow, or sometimes in many places there is no internet.
The idea of Arimóvil came from an alliance of three news websites that Venezuela's media regulator, Conatel, frequently blocked. Media watchdogs say Venezuela has a history of blocking access to independent news, and that the country's journalists work amid restrictions and threats of legal or physical attack.
Our target is the citizen. We decided not to stay put and stay censored, but to go look for the citizen bringing our information to the neighborhoods.
By also reporting on problems in the neighborhoods they visit, the team helps form a bond with the community.
There is no place where residents can report problems in their communities. The Arimóvil will allow or already allows the possibility for residents to come forward to make their complaint to talk about their needs.
As night draws in, people gather in the street to watch videos on issues affecting their country. For Adriana Núñez Rabascal in Caracas, Venezuela, Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
This has been International Edition of The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. And you can also download the VOA app. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains committed to bringing all American hostages and wrongful detainees home. At the recent inaugural U.S. Hostage and Wrongful Detainee Day, Secretary of State Antony Blinken recounted how he carries a list with the name of every American who is held hostage or unjustly detained. Over the past 3 years, he noted, I've been able to cross 46 names off that list. And yet dozens of our fellow citizens are held without cause by foreign governments, terrorist groups, and other non-state actors, without their rights and apart from their families, said Secretary Blinken.
Families who, month by month, minute by minute, endure the agony of not knowing where their loved one is being held, whether they're suffering, or when they'll see them again. To those families, know this. We will keep fighting for your family members as if they were our own. We will not give up, ever.
The U.S. will keep expanding and strengthening the tools it has to get hostages back, including the Hostage Recovery Group, which brings together the State Department, the White House, the intelligence community, and other parts of the government to coordinate efforts to free unjustly detained Americans and provide support for their families. And like the 2020 Robert Levinson Act, it empowers the U.S. to impose additional financial penalties and travel restrictions on the hostage takers. We've teamed up with Canada to lead a group of more than 70 countries who have endorsed a declaration against arbitrary detention by states and who strive to stand together against any government that uses foreign nationals as bargaining chips, explained Secretary Blinken.
The more countries who join us in applying pressure, the more we raise the cost on perpetrators, and the more we force them to think twice before detaining additional innocent people. And that's crucial to ensuring that no one else has to live through this nightmare.
Every day that we fight for the release of unjustly detained Americans, whether that we is our government, a community, a family, or an individual, we show who we are, said Secretary Blinken, and what we value most, our freedom, our humanity, and our readiness to bring to bear the strength of an entire nation to defend the rights of a single citizen.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.